get to do the introduction. Anybody who saw the sheet, there's really not much she could possibly add to a list of accomplishments and achievements that list presents, so I'm not going to review it.
Just
I'll say this.
I have a copy of the list.
It's the one you sent.
Fiction writer.
But, so I'll tell you, for somebody of my age growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, when I did, Rabbi Julie Berman stands for the fact that basically anything is possible. You could be Frum, you could be a successful lawyer, you could be close to Gedolin, you could be the leader of the community. Anything is possible, and you're not limited in any way. And when I see him, I think about that, and when I thought of what to say today, I thought it's the only thing I could say. People talk about, you know, your reach not exceeding your grasp. In his case, they're exactly the same. Hard to imagine anything he tried to achieve in his life that he didn't achieve. It's a schus for me, it's a schus for us that he's here today, and I'd ask him to present.
I appreciate the introduction. One of the dangers of that kind of introduction is it raises the anticipation of the speakers. And that is a danger. And I thought I would sort of bring it down to a lower level, the one I could possibly reach. How many of you understand Yiddish? A rousing response. So let me give it to you in English, which already loses half the taste. Now, there was this American tourist. He was in Eretz Yisrael. He gets up Shabbos morning, and today is his day to do Mea Shearim. Takes his ubiquitous camera with him, starts walking in Mea Shearim, and sees a little boy with a white shirt, dark pants. And he walks over to him. He remembers his Mama Lushin from way, way back. And he says, "Vos is dein Namen?" What is your name? The kid looks at him totally blank, as if he doesn't understand a word. He repeats, "Vos is dein Namen?" Again, total blank. You're talking about American. He says, "Du verstehst nicht Yiddish?" You don't understand Yiddish? Finally, the kid couldn't hold it in anymore. He says, "Where's your koppel?" You're talking to an American. American's always quick with a response. The American looks up at the heaven, and he says, "That's my koppel." The kid looks up, down, looks at his ball plate and back and forth, and he says, "That koppel is a little too big for that little kepala." I appreciate the introduction, but let's bring it down. Although, you know, you can interpret it the other way, knowing Eli Weber as well as I do, when he says that I prove that anybody can reach the level, I'm wondering what he's meaning by that. Is that a pejorative or? What I want to talk to you today is about the Rav. I see from the age involved, most of you, that it's talking about the Rav, that very few of you actually met the Rav or heard the Rav, unless other by tapes. A few Divrei Torah, and then I want to talk really about the personality. I asked for a chumash. Oh, thank you. We all know, the Rebbe Par excellence, the intellectual giant in so many different fields, the Baal Darshan, the philosopher, even in his Hesbedim, he was just absolutely phenomenal. But all right, those are just descriptions. What I want to do is start with a simple Dvar Torah from just a few weeks ago. And it's going to reflect two things, I believe. Number one, it's going to reflect that sometimes the Rav will ask a simple question, and it's so simple, it drives you up the wall, why you didn't think of it yourself. You have to go to Rav Soloveitchik to hear the question. It's so obvious. And then when he comes up with the answer, you realize that there's more to it than you thought there was, and there's a whole development in terms of Hashkafa, in terms of how to relate to the world. We read, and many of you have heard it possibly before, some of you, Eil Tov is Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram Holed is Yitzchak. I doubt if there's a person sitting here that doesn't know that first Rashi. Why, it already said Yitzchak ben Avram, why does it repeat Avram Holed is Yitzchak? Says Rashi, because Litzone Yose Ador, the mockers of that generation said, hey, this couple didn't have children for years and years and years. Then we had the incident with Avimelech, and now they have a kid. So who knows? Who says it's Avram's child? And therefore, Avram holed es Yitzchak, tzor klas tefani shel Yitzchak, that you can see that Yitzchak is a, you can see just looking at him, that Yitzchak is the son of Avram. The Rav asks a very simple question. Let's analyze that for a moment. Whenever you look at a childless couple, if you look from outside, you say, hey, I know there's a problem. There's a childless couple. They've been married for many years. But who knows? Maybe it's in the wife. Maybe it's in the husband. It's childless. But in the case of Avram and Sarah, is there any question where the problem was? Avram had already had a child, right? Yishmael. And we see later, when he gets remarried with Keturah, he's going to have 6 more children. So obviously, Avram had no problem in having children. Where was the problem? Sarah. Chodali Sarah Kenoshim. She no longer was a childbearing age. She never had had a child. So Avimelech coming along, how does that solve any problems? You still have the same basic. So why does it say Avram Holid is Yitzchak? What's Litzone Yose Ador have to do with it? So then, and then the Rav adds another incident. A little later, in the same Sedra, you have something unusual. The Plishtim had nothing better than to do after Avram died than to go around and find every well that Avram had dug, wells of water, visitmum, and they filled them up. They're not better than do, I don't know. But that's for the Plishtim. Who cares about the Plishtim? But what did Yitzchak do? Should be sitting and learning. Should be sitting tending flocks. Should be sitting doing something. What does he do? He goes to every one of the wells that his father had dug, and that the Plishtim, exactly it says this in Pasuk, that the Plishtim had filled up, and he unfills them, he takes out everything that the Plishtim did, makes them actual wells again, and even calls them the same names. Pasuk goes out of the way to mention, calls them the same names that Avram called them. Says the Rav, first of all, when you learn the Torah, everybody knows you learn Gemara, whoever goes, every word they have to work out what it means and why it's there. Not only words, sometimes a letter. Why an extra letter? Why Sukkos? With above, with what above, with 2 above. And they darshan from it. And over here, there's a story about this wells. Plishtim filled them up. Yitzchak opened them up. Called them the same names. What's happening here? Says the Rav, and this is fundamental. Says the Rav, the Plishtim had a problem, or you can say Litzone Yose Ador had a problem. The Plishtim had a problem. Their problem was Avram. Here was a man, we know all about him being Titanem Ziyakot Chesed Avram, being the paradigm of Chesed, the tent with the four doors. We even know when he thought the 3 angels came, and he thought they were 3, not angels. They weren't angels at all. He thought what they were. Who were they? They were over the Avodah Zarah. So what did he do? He said, I want you to wipe, to wash off your feet, because that's the Avodah Zarah. But you, over the Avodah Zarah, come in. I'll work for you. I'm prepared to welcome you. You're a human being like anybody else. And then, of course, the ultimate. He believed in the one God, in the incorporeal God, the one you can't feel, you can't touch, you can't make images out of for. But they had one solace. And what was it? Avram is mortal. There's going to come a point in time when Avram is out. Finished. Going to get rid of him. And sure enough, Avram died, and one of the first things that they did is they filled up the wells. What were the wells? The wells were a reflection of what Avram did on this in this earth. And their job was to wipe Avram out of history. Avram was there. You think he was there? Not at all. In fact, go look around. There's nothing that shows that Avram was there at all. So what does Yitzchak do? This Avram, who is Yitzchak? Yitzchak goes ahead and digs up very wells that Avram had dug that they had covered up, and he calls them the same name. What was he doing? He was telling the world that Avram never left. That what Avram started, I Yitzchak, and that's Avram Holidus Yitzchak, I Yitzchak will continue on, and in the tafkid of all of us throughout the years, is exactly that, to continue the very tradition that Avram started, and I'll discuss some of that a little later. I recall, you know, I'm heavily involved in the claims conference, and the claims conference has to do with getting money from Germany for survivors, etc. But we're also involved with education. Yesterday I had to speak to a group of people about education. When I say education, I'm talking about show education. And I mentioned that how quick it goes. Usually when you talk about education, especially with the survivors, you say there's going to come a point in time when the survivors will no longer be around, and there's going to be, people are going to start redoing history. They're going to start revising history. Well, we learned very quickly that they didn't have to wait till the survivors were left. They're already revising history. Certainly in Eretz Yisrael, you know they're revising history. Now I understand the temple was not in Yerushalayim, it was in Nablus. I understand all everything. In the New York Times, there are some of you not from America? Yeah. Few of you. Well, you probably know this anyway. New York Times, December 7th, 2011. 70 years after what? So there's somebody, so they write up this on the front page of the Times, that there was a person who was in the war, and he was at Pearl Harbor, and now it's 70 years later, now he's in the war, don't forget, he was in the Army, or the Navy. And you can imagine, now he's in the upper 80s, and he used to go around every year to talk to younger people, to tell them what it was, Pearl Harbor. And he mentions, he went into a class, and the person that introduced him said, he is going to be talking about Pearl Harbor, to which a nice young lady sitting there said, who is she? It goes very quick. And in any event, but that is, as I say, that is how the Rav described, how the Rav asked a very simple question and then used a profound answer to respond to it. 1982. Yeah, the reason I know 1982 because I was chairman of the Council of Presidents of American Jewish Organizations at the time, and I received either Chalmei Sukkos or immediately after Sukkos, I received a call from the Rav Zatzal. He says, Julie, he says, what's this magazine, Olam Hazeh? I don't even think it exists anymore, does it? No. Say, Rebbe, it's a rag. I assure you it's not for you. Why are you asking? He says, I just received a telephone call from Eretz Yisrael, and they told me that in Olam Hazeh they published that I was so exercised about the whole issue of Sabra Shatila. Do you know what Sabra Shatila was all about? You learned in history, right? You had the, in June, Shalom Lech Halil, Sharon went up the, up. That's another question is, I remember meeting with Vice President Bush, and he is in the middle of this, and they were very excited in Washington. He says, where's he going? Where's he going? When's he going to stop? As you go up further and further to Beirut. Somebody once asked, I remember Begin, somebody asked, tell me, this is a diversion, I apologize. Tell me, when Sharon goes up there, does he tell you where he's going and what he's going to do? He says, yeah, sometimes before, sometimes after, but eventually I find out what he's doing. So Sagar Shatila, so in September, you know what happened. They had the massacre by the Christians of the Muslims in September of 82, and the whole world was dumping all over Israel that they have participated, that conspired, and therefore, for all intents and purposes, the Christians were doing the bidding of the Israelis in going ahead into Sabra Shatila and the camps there. And so there's a big tararam here in Eretz Yisrael about having a judicial commission, of having a commission to investigate, like they did just recently, the, what was the name of the Supreme Court? What's his name? The Supreme Court Justice that's the head of the recent commission. Who?
Trachtenberg.
No. It was a, he's retired. Who?
Oh, that's...
No.
Winograd.
Nope.
One.
Winograd is not a justice. All right, I'll think of it in a moment. Anyway, 2 moments. And there was a big to-do whether or not he's going to convene a judicial commission. Begin's initial reaction was a beautiful Yiddish phrase, which of course is going to get lost here. Goyim hagen in goyim und schuldig sein in the Eden. Goyim are killing goyim, and who's responsible? Of course the Jews. In any event, so this Olam Hazeh published that Rav Soloveitchik from Israel, from America, was so incensed about the fact that that Begin was not convening a commission, a judicial commission to investigate, that he called him on Yom Kippur. So this is the Rav exercise, getting a little upset. He says, I want to sue them for libel. Now, Eli Weber will tell you, the last thing in the world you do is sue a rag for libel. Two things happen. Number one, they just keep on going for 3 or 4 years. You spend money and money and money. Then eventually, if you get a monetary judgment, you find out there's no money at the end of the road. So you wasted all that time. You had Agos Nefesh for 4 years, and you got nothing out of it. So my job was to convince the road, forget it. But you just don't tell the road, forget it. I don't anyway. So I said, Rebbe, let me give you a primer on libel. Number one, it has to be an alleged fact. Number two, it has to be a fact, a false fact. And number three, it has to be to your damage if you want to sue. It can't be to your damage unless it's believable. Because if people will laugh it off saying it can't happen, then you're not getting hurt by it. So I paused. So I said, Rebbe, I know you think I'm going to say, Rebbe, nobody would believe it. No way. I said, Rebbe, people would believe that you would call on Yom Kippur, but nobody would believe that Vega would answer the phone. Even the Rav had a laugh. Once he was laughing, I knew I had him. Of course, the Rav is the Rav. He never got the last word. He says, yeah, but there was 7 hours later. Something I was going to talk about here. All right. This is just a minor incident, just to show you the type of person he was. I was sitting in his home. It was a Cholomet Sukkos. He used to try to do that. And his daughter comes over and says, there's a call from this and this country. He tells me immediately who it's from, and he knows that the person who's calling is going to tell him that he just got engaged to this girl who is the daughter of this Rosh Hashiva. So he gets on the phone and he says, Ma'adim Lasimcha, yeah, how are you? Yeah? No. Mazel tov to whom? He went through this whole charade. And when it was over, and of course he gave him the grace. Oh, of course he did. He didn't know the girl, but he said her father is a world leader, Abisal Guzma. But anyway, it was absolutely, as I say, just a play. He finally comes back, he sits down, and I looked at him. I said, Rebbe, you told me who it was. You knew what was going to happen. And what'd you go through there? So, as I say, the charade. So he said very simply, he says, you can tell from the phone on the other side that he was so happy he was able to call me to tell me about this development in his life, that there was no way in the world I was going to detract him and remove that piece of satisfaction of letting him tell me as if I didn't know. That was the rub. In later life, there's all different stories. In later life, when he was still coming and giving shiurim, I used to meet with him on Wednesday nights. One time, and this is really indicative because, you know, I call myself a Kalta Mitznagid. My wife laughs, and I'm not sure why, other than the fact she's a Galiziana. And this is really interesting, his approach, not only towards life, towards his Talmidim. My appointment was for 8:30. I go into the apartment, I knock on the door, he opens the door, and as he opens the door, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, I don't know if you know who he is, Rabbi Menachem Ganak, two things. Number one, three things. He's a Rebbe in Yisrochanan. But he was and is the head of the Kashrus Commission of the OU. And he was sitting and working with him, with a Rav, on his Ksavim, which eventually became Shiurim Lezecha Abamavi, where he was converting his Dvashas into the printed word. And he gets out, and I come in, I go through my agenda, and as I'm finished and as I'm leaving, he says, wait a second, I want to talk to you about something. He says, what is it? Somebody raised with me something that the OU is doing kashrus-wise that I'd like you to look into. At that time, I was the chairman of the Kashrus Commission, but as a layperson, the full-time person, the rabbinic administrator, was Rabbi Ganak. So maybe it was a little chutzpah, but I said the obvious question. Rabbi, this makes no sense. You just spent an hour with Rabbi Ganak. You raise now with me a kashrus issue. You know what's going to happen. I'm going to have to go to Ganak and raise the issue with him. He's going to give me whatever the story is. I'm going to come back to you, and then you're going to say, but. Then I'm going to have to go, why don't you speak to him? He's right there. Speak to him, straighten it all out. And then the Rav told me and taught me, I'm a halacha wife. He says, my relationship with Rabbi Ganak is such that there's no question in the world that when I raise the issue, he will immediately detect that I'm troubled by something. And right or wrong, he will then make the appropriate changes to make sure that the Rav is satisfied. But you know something? Then I became the administrator of the Kashrus Commission. I don't want that. Ganak has to develop to be the administrator of the Rabbinic Kashrus Commission. And he has to realize that even if I raise the issue, the ultimate person who has to decide is the person who's running the organization on a day-to-day basis. That was his approach, which as you can see, is totally different than the old joke about as you get to smicha, you get a telephone number on the other side. So if there's in case there's any ever a real question, call the Rebbe, call the Rosh Hashiva. He felt it was so important that each of us would develop our capabilities so that there will come a point in time where we could paskin our own child. And in this case, it would be in a matter of policy. But again, he's not the Rebbeinu Kashrus administrator, Rabbi Ganak is. There was another time, it's interesting because my grandson is here and he's going to be naming a baby in a couple of days. And the Rebbe is sitting there. And I come in, and he was in a reminiscing mood. And he says, "Where's my name come from?" Now, my mechutin is a historian. I'm not. But you don't have to be a historian to know where Yosef Dov Halevi comes from. It's his great-grandfather, you know, the Beis Halevi. So I said, "It's the Beis Halevi, so what's the issue? So what's the question?" So I look at him. He's toying with me. He says, "I have no questions. You're named after your great-grandson, after your great-grandfather, and that's it. And it continues the tradition." He says, "Yeah, there is a question. Think it through for a moment." And he frames the episode. He says, my mother just gave birth to me. And it's not like nowadays, where give them a day and a half, maybe two, and they throw you out of the hospital. In those days, you're alive and you're alive and you're alive. Eventually, you got up. And she hears a knock on the door. And she looks, and there's her shver, Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim comes in, says, "Nu Pesha, how are you? How do you feel?" Now comes the question. He says, "Pesha, you know, by us, by uns, the minig is as the mother gets the first name." Now you see the question. "But I want you to know that my father, Zal, has been nifter already 11 years, and there's nobody named after him. Maybe this time you would be mevater and allow us to have the first name." He says, "You know, my mother's lying there. Reb Chaim is standing there. You know, she had a choice. So I ended up with that name. But since I ate the kol to misnaget, the first thing I did when I got home is I took out the encyclopedia. And sure enough, 1892, 1903. The Beis Halevi passed away in 1892. Rebbe was born now. So the first part was correct. Then, a day or two later, I forget when, maybe it was even longer, I called, or I was on a conversation with, I can't remember whether it was the daughter of Tora Tversky or the daughter of Tova Lichtenstein. And I told her the episode, and I just asked whether she had heard about it. And she says, "That's exactly what happened. Did my father tell you anything else?" So now I'm already quizzical. So I said, "What else was there to tell?" She says, "Well, what he didn't tell you is that he got the first name. That is, Reb Chaim got the first name, but then my mother's side got the next five." So that's what you do when you're trading star players, right? There was another time. Again, it was in a reminiscing mood, which is very unusual for the Rebbe, but as he got older, it happened more often. And he's sitting with a piece of paper. And I asked him, he showed it to me, I don't remember what. And I said, "What is it?" And he says, "This is the invitation that Reb Chaim sent out for the wedding of his son Moshe," that was the Rebbe's father, "and Peshke, which is the Rebbe's mother, the Shadow Peshke." Do you notice anything unique about this? So I looked and looked, so I didn't quite see it. So what's unique about it? So he says, look at the bottom. He says, one thing I can assure you, Reb Chaim was not known as a feminist. Notice how he signed. Hamavakshim, those who are inviting. Chaim Halevi, immediately underneath Lipsha, his wife, and against both of them, Soloveitchik. This is in contrast to now when you never even see the wife's, the mother's name, and it becomes the Hayoso, right? But that was, as I say, that was just a reminisce that he mentioned to me and he showed it to me. I mean, then of course gave me a copy. You know, we talk so much. I don't know if they do it here, but in America they do it quite a bit, about modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, Torah Mada, the Chatchila, B'Devet. Whether it's our fault or otherwise, I just simply don't recall, not that I heard every word that the Rav ever said, I don't recall the Rav ever using those phraseologies or even talking those ways, that in those terms. But I do recall at the Bar Torah he said that I believe really reflects the Rav's view towards this world and how we should relate to the world. And it's not, as I say, the two word phrases, modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy, Torah Mada. It's something else. It's four words that Avram self-described when he came to Bnei Ches to purchase some land to bury his late wife. And what were those words? Ger v'toshav anochi machem. And I wrote out this once before, and I'm going to read it quickly because I think it does better than when I do it extemporaneously. And it's as follows. A stranger and a resident I am among you, Ger v'toshav anochi machem. Two terms, seemingly mutually exclusive. One is either a stranger, an alien, or one is a resident, a citizen. How could Avram claim both identities for himself? Avram's definition of his dual status, says the Rav, describes with profound accuracy the historical position of the Jew who resides in a predominantly non-Jewish society. He was a resident, like other inhabitants of Canaan, sharing with them a concern for the welfare of society, even engaged in the mundane activities that we just talked about of digging wells and contributing to the progress of the country in loyalty to its government and institutions. Here, Avram was clearly a fellow citizen, a patriot among compatriots, joining others in advancing the common welfare. However, there was another aspect, the spiritual, in which Avram regarded himself as a stranger. His identification and solidarity with his fellow citizens in the secular realm did not imply his readiness to relinquish any aspects of his religious uniqueness. His was a different faith, and he was governed by perceptions, truths, and observances which set him apart from the larger faith community. In this regard, Avram and his descendants were and would always remain strangers. In my opinion, this is a central motif of our way of life, and it was with that in mind that we continue on in life. And I recall then the Rav once, I don't know if it was at that occasion or subsequently, just had an addendum to that. And he says, remember when we went to Har Maria with Akedas Yitzchak, what does he say? He looks at Elazar and Yishmael, and he says, Vatem, what does it say? Teshvu, Shvu lochem po, Vani vanar nilchot ko v'nishtachve. You sit here, we will do our thing, we relate to our Lord. But, what's the next words? V'nishuv alecha. But then we come back to you. Because we're part of this world, we're part of this community, and we're going to share with you what happens in this community. And just on a minor thing, we know, for example, those who are in the cheer, knew Tuesday morning of the of election day in November. Either or. Either we have an early shiur so the Rav can run back to Massachusetts to vote. Not to run. He took a plane. Or the other way around. To have a later shiur so the Rav could vote before he came into America. He felt very, very strong. Which of course comes to another area, and that is subscribing and obeying the laws of the country, not just Dina de Malchusa, which usually focuses on Chosh Mitzvah Ben Or Mechavera. He was extremely insistent in terms of taxes. Now, I'm not here just to tell you you have to pay your taxes. Of course, you have to make money first. But I recall two things. One was I once received a call from his mother, his wife, his future, let's try it again, his daughter, who says, I was heavily involved with him when it came to publishing all his publications and with the royalties, etc. And his daughter called me and said, do me a favor, tell my father that don't worry, whenever we get a royalty check, I report it to the accountant, and it's docketed, and you pay taxes, Dagenish. But something else happened. I had become the president of the Orthodox Union. This goes back a few years. I became president in 78, so. And I had heard a rumor. I call it a rumor because I don't want to testify. That there were a few people paid off the books. I think you know what that means. And being a conservative Park Avenue lawyer and having a colleague like Ellie Weber around, I knew I couldn't let that continue on. So I didn't even ask, is it true, is it not true? I called the executive vice president and I told him, whatever it was, it was. That's history. From now on, that's it. He quibbled a little with me, but he saw the handwriting on the wall, and so that was it. A few weeks later, I received a call from the then regional director of the NCSY in New Jersey. I specifically say New Jersey because the Rav had spoken in New Jersey to that region before. He knew how well developed it was, and it was unique, not that I'm here for that purpose, in terms of the NCSY, because it's unique because it was a community that had both yeshiva boys and girls and public school boys and girls. Sometime you have to program either one or the other, and they were able to really develop a kesher. And he calls me and he says, I just got your dictate, and I just want you to know that I have one person on my staff, he's my assistant, and I just don't know. I can't do it to him. So I said, why not? So he said, he has two other positions. If he takes this, he's going to just about give everything to the government. I don't know if I can keep him. So it was easy for me. I'm sitting in, I said, by Park Avenue firm, right? And I say, there's nothing to do. He then has this punchline. He says, could I speak to the Rav about this? So I said, be my guest. Speak to the Rav, and believe me, whatever the Rav tells me to do, I will do it. A few days later, I get a call from him. Those that know Yeshiva, probably not many of you do, but there was a telephone booth outside of his apartment, and it's this person calling me, and he's crestfallen. He says, I was fully prepared. I came with all my tinnitus. One, two, three, four. I got absolutely no place. Then I decided I'm going to pull out of my bag the real trick. I say, Rebbe, I want you to know that if you insist on him on putting him on the payroll, which means taxes, Social Security, everything goes with it, there's a good chance he's going to quit. And I'm telling you now, I have no full confidence that I can continue in the region without him. He's that important to me. As a matter of hindsight, I think he overdid a little bit, but that's what he said. And he's telling me this. So the Rav gave him four words. I'm going to close the region, right? So close the region. If you can't run the region without paying taxes, without listening to the laws and complying with the laws, then don't bother. Close the region. Well, I mean, the post, you know obviously what happened. Put him on the payroll. He didn't quit. They didn't close the region. But that's what the rub was when it came to these things. There are certain strong principles he held. There was no movement, no back and forth. And there was no, certainly there was no opening of just doing something because justifying, you know, the end justified the means, because it's Shem Shemayim, it's important, we have to do it. And so we bended a little here. There was no bending when it came to the rub. I have somebody told me I gotta close out. We're back to the reminiscence stage. So he tells me he once came home and he found his grandfather in the house. And he's obviously very, very young. So I show my bikis, you mean Reb Chaim? So then he scolds me a little bit. He says, wait a second, I had two grandfathers. It was Reb Elia Pushinger. What? So then he tells me and repeats to me, this is what, from 60, 70 years ago. He repeats to me the little dialogue he had with his grandfather. Nu Yeshaber, what did you learn today? So he said, we learned the Gemara about what happens if you have more, if you find more than one set of tefillin on Shabbos. You have to take them in one at a time, put them on in order because of the issue of Baltosin. So Rav Elia, his grandfather, says, Nu, what's the kasha? I mean, this is, you know, you're talking shorthand when it comes to these, that element of the world. He says the kasha is the Tosis in Lulav HaGazel. Tosis in Lulav HaGazel says, what happens? How do you make a bracha ovelasiyasin to the, right? How do you make a bracha ovelasiyasin to the lulav, kevan sha'ag be'nafke? Once you pick it up, you're already yotze. How can you make a bracha? It's too late. So the Gemara goes to, the Tosis goes to a whole series. One is that starts thinking maybe you can leave it on the table, make the bracha and pick it up. He says, no, it has to be taken. Then he says, well, you can maybe keep it separate, one of the two. Another is the way we do it. We have to hit the marup, you know, underneath. And then he says, and then he gets a third teretz Tosis to say, that you don't have kavana to be yotze the mitzvah until you make the bracha. And then Tosis adds, and if you hold mitzvahs einu tzriches kavana, then the answer is simple. Even if you hold mitzvahs einu tzriches kavana, hepech kavana is sufficient. So that's the Tosis. So what's it got to do with this? So he says, simple. Why don't you put on two pairs of tefillin at once with hepech kavana? That what? That you're not going to be yotze. And there's no, if they're not going to be yotze, there's no bal Tosis. So again, believe me, he's not showing off, certainly not to me. So his grandfather asked him, Nu, Yashaber? So what's the teretz? He says, it's as follows. In every mitzvah, there's the maisa mitzvah, right? The act. And then there's kiyum mitzvah. That, you know, brisket Torah, everybody knows that, right? And quite often, the maisa mitzvah and the kiyum mitzvah are exactly the same. You pick up, you make a bracha whether you make a bracha or don't make a bracha on the Esrog and Lulav, that's the Maisim, it's the Key Mitzvah. There are certain exceptions, of course, namely Tefillah, you have Avelus, you have a few cases where Kriyashma where the Maaseh Mitzvah is Act A, and the Kiyum Mitzvah, it's, in many cases, its impact on you. It's Kabbalah, Soma, Shemayim, it's the various things, he said. He says, Hepa Kavana breaks off the Maaseh Mitzvah from the Kiyum Mitzvah. So you may have picked up the Lulav and the Esreg, and you had the Maaseh Mitzvah, but you didn't, but since you had Hepa Kavana, so therefore you didn't have there was no Kiyum Mitzvah, he says. Baal Tosif is a psul in the Maaseh Mitzvah. So once you pick it up, once you put on two pairs of tefillin, you've already had a Baal Tosif. Again, I'm not here and I'm not asking you whether the Rav was right or wrong. I would ask him along those lines. But I'm just saying, here he is, 70 some odd years later, maybe I think it's close to 80, and just, as I say, reminiscing and talking about the type of intelligence he had, even as far back as that. As I say, I have my biggest problem is I can go on and on. Let me just tell you a few things about inhibitions. I once asked him something. I was chairman of the Council of Presidents, and I wanted to discuss something with him. And whether I should take a position on this and this issue, what should it be? Knowing eventually he told me that it's your call. He gave me a piece of mussar right there that I'll never, never forget. In Yiddish, and then I'll translate it in English. So listen, it says, Herzachain Berman, Mimusni Tovna Deyot Yadazach. There's no need that everybody has to take a position on every little thing. And then he went on. And if you do take a position, you have to know when to do it, to whom to say it, and how to say it. And if you think in terms of the Rav and his life, and the public positions he took along the way, whether it was with the Tkiyas HaShofar in the conservative synagogue, whether it was confrontation, interreligious dialogue, you can count them on one finger, on one hand. Because, and therefore they were that much more, they're much more pronounced, and that's why they were much more accepted. There are other Rosh Yeshiva that every day of the week they come out with another pronouncement, and it just goes by the wayside. And I'll never forget, that was a piece of mussar to me. On the other hand, talking about mussar, I remember, and I was once in a car with him, and we had just learned Shabbos, and we were talking about Bisho Achabisho, warming an infant's milk on Shabbos, whether pasteurized is one Bisho Achabisho Dovalach, but not everybody holds it, but we paskin that way. And then I gave him, and he told me, and he felt, but on the other hand, don't forget milk that you're warming. Bidapke, you don't want to warm it so it's too hot, because it won't do you any good, right? Just the opposite. So I told him, I just told him, I don't do that. I don't rely on that. I told him, like, no, it's very simple. I just take from the Kli Rishon and put it in Kli Sheni, and then it's Dovalach, and I just warm it in Kli Sheni. So I also will not forget what he told me. Again, in Yiddish, it's much better in Yiddish. It says, Hel Zechayim Belman, Zayni Kein Tzadik Oif Nzun's Cheshbin. Don't be a tzadik on your son's account. And years and years later, I was learning. I remember the whole issue, you know, about eating birthday cake on Shabbos, whether when you're eating cake that has sur socios, and of course you have the famous tshuva, I think kuf yutes of the Ramah, and then there's others that hold this close to it, the Raisa, and I remember the Dogma Vava, the Nodi Yehuda, having a long mahalach, saying he doesn't see any problem with it, but, and then if maybe they ate it for school, it's misakin, not mekalkin. And then he concludes with one line, v'machmer yachmer l'atzmo v'lo l'acher. If you want to be machmer, be my guest, but don't impose it on others. There's much to talk about. I can keep on going, but I'm afraid somebody will give me the key and say close up when it finished. So let me just finish with something, with a different Dvar Torah, but it's not really Dvar Torah, that the Rav left us with, which I don't believe is written up at all. We all know the famous Brisket Torah on Dalakosos. What happened was, according to the Rav, he says he recalls it, what happened was his father was the Rav in Kaslovich, his uncle, Rav Elva Brisker, was visiting, it was Pesach, there wasn't enough wine, so they had this, they sat down among themselves and had this developed, this theory, what is the halacha of Dalakosos? In other words, this analysis. Is it halacha Dalakosos like matzah? You drink Dalako, you drink it 1, 2, 3, 4, yoisa? Or no, is it like Kiddush? Kiddush, you make a Kiddush, and you make a bracha Alakosos. Birchas Hamazon, you make it Alakosos. Now, of course, we know when it comes to the Seder, that the way the Chacham set it up is you have four kosas, one with Kiddush, one with Haggadah, one with Hallel, no, one with Kiddush, one with Haggadah, one with Birchas Hamazon, and one with Hallel. Ask the Gemara, what about Shosan B'Vasacha? What if you drink them all at once? So there's a, as I say, it's all brisket Torah, which I'm not going to repeat here. There's a Girsa of the Rambam in the Gemara about which one is Shosan Chai, Shosan Vasachas. But the bottom line is that the way the Gemara reads, it says Shosan Vasachas is Yedeyayin Yotza, the halacha of a simple blabasa Yayin Yotza, but Yedey Dalakosos Lo Yotza. So I repeat, he goes through the whole brisket Torah, that there's two different aspects, etc. He's finished, and we're ready to leave. And he's not getting up. And we think the shiur's over. He started, made the analysis, came to the conclusions, and it's over. And he pauses, and he says as follows. You're all the brisket Torah put aside for the moment, but on a very simple level. He drank the Dalakosos. He ate the matzah, so he didn't make the bracha on the matzah, but he was yotze the matzah. He drank the Dalakosos. Why do we say yotze Dalakosos lo yotze? So this was, call it drush, call it what you want, but it was just so beautiful. He says, what is reflected by Dalakosos, as he would say, was the badait the Dalakosos, chayrus, we all know that. Freedom. To be sure, after 210 years of fashklafim, of slavery, you get out, you have a right to reflect freedom. One good way of reflecting freedom is go in a local bar and get drunk. 1, 2, 3, 4. The Rabbonin said, that's not cheres by Jews. Cheres by Jews is ala brachas. That is with Kedusha. And the Rabbanan were teaching us not a Mahalich and Dalakosos, but a Mahalich how you live in the free world. When I was chairman of the Council of Presidents, twice a year the reporters from Israel would always come to visit, a little before Pesach and a little before Rosh Hashanah, because there was always a special Pesach number and Rosh Hashanah number of the local newspaper in Israel. And they would always ask the very same question. They had to fill up the pages, right? So tell me, what is the problem with Judaism in America? Assimilation, intermarriage. So I said, and I always said in those days, assimilation and intermarriage are results of the problem. Unfortunately, the problem is chavrus. We have learned through our bitter years to know how to live through adversity. There's a, I think it's called the Moritzia, there's an achron that Paskin, putting aside whether you're allowed to read on Chitzonim on Shabbos, but he Paskin, you can't read Jewish history on Shabbos. Why? It says if you read Jewish history, you become umedik, you become depressed. This is what we lived through all these years, etc. And on Shabbos, you shouldn't be depressed. It says that's when, as I say, when the goyim make sure they know you know you're Jews and you have no alternative, we know how to live. We've lived relatively well considering that. Our biggest problem is to live in freedom. And that, the Rub, and with this he closed, and that is the objective for all of you as you go out into the world. Live in the world and among the world, but always remember, live ala brachas with Kedusha. Thank you.
It's possible.
Thank you. Well, yes, I've got a lot of questions.